Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be interviewing Lynn Harris about when pregnancy becomes a tool for domestic violence. Also, is Regina Benjamin's weight relevant to her job performance? And whatever will the country do with Sarah Palin? I'd like to take a moment to plug a couple of things related to this podcast and to RH Reality Check. First of all, big thanks to the people who've put up reviews at iTunes. That helps us build a bigger audience and reach more people. If you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you could drop by and give the podcast a review. Also, if you're going to Netroots Nation, and I really hope you are, please come check out the panel that I'm moderating called Reproductive Rights in the Age of Obama. We've got panelists from Advocates for Youth, Guttmacher, the Pro-Choice Public Education Project, and RH Reality Check to talk about how to promote reproductive rights in this new era. You can tell from the screenshot of the video on the page that this clip, that Talking Points memo got off Fox News, is going to be the classiest thing that they've ever done. How? Because there's a guy being interviewed by Neil Cavuto wearing a shirt that says No Chubbies. And yes, they're talking about the new nominee for Surgeon General, and you're not wrong to suspect that this is as much about Regina Benjamin being black and female as it is her weight. Pamela Merritt wrote a piece for RH Reality Check on this that you should read, and says what needs to be said on this. But the beauty of podcasting is you can include actual jaw-dropping clips of the depraved abuse of Dr. Benjamin for daring to be female and not a size 2. And so I present to you Fox News and their ridiculous fat-shaming of Dr. Regina Benjamin.
Michael Karalczyk says she's a bad example. Michael, CEO of the Anti-Gym. And Michael, why so anti-Dr. Benjamin?
Well, thanks again, Neil, for having me. And, you know, I've already got my bulletproof vest underneath my shirt today, so I'm safe leaving because this is an anger a lot of your female audience. But the bottom line is Dr. Benjamin is 50 pounds overweight. She is obese. She's a size 20.
She's 50 pounds overweight? There's no way that
she's 50 pounds minimum.
She doesn't look 50 pounds overweight to me.
Oh, she is, Neil. I have a lot of experience in this. 50 to 60 pounds overweight. She is obese. And now
Cavuto plays the good guy, sort of. He's doing the you're not that fat thing instead of dealing with the real issue, which is, so what? I like how the guest, who is the owner of a gym where they scream at you if you have any visible body fat, makes it clear up front that this is about being a woman, and that women have a special responsibility to be skinny if they want any access to public life or social esteem.
She'd still make a darn good Surgeon General. Well, maybe have someone with more empathy for the obesity epidemic in this country.
Okay, let's then turn the tables, Neil. Would you then want your head of the Fed Reserve to be a guy that lives in a cardboard box underneath the highway because he understands the plight of poor people and he understands how to make money work?
Well, I think given the press he's gotten, he does live in a cardboard box underneath the highway, but that's another issue. But go ahead.
Oh, whatever. God forbid we should have anyone with sympathy for people who actually struggle in positions to make decisions about our economy. But let's carry on, because there's a bunch of assumptions being trotted out about fat people's basic character that will make your head spin.
Not that she was born this way, not that she woke up one day and was obese. She is shown through being lazy and making poor food choices
No. Now, how do you know anything about her lifestyle? There are a lot of people who might be a little fat, but they're very fit. And you might have people who seem very thin, and apparently they're not so fit. So,
lazy? Lazy? I love that a guy that runs a gimmicky gym that has had some financial troubles is accusing a doctor whose endless energy and enthusiasm has led her to get this nomination. Lindsay Beierstein wrote a post explaining how Dr. Benjamin was the first person under 40 to run the AMA. She got an MBA on top of her medical degree, founded her own clinic that reaches out to lower-income people, worked with Katrina refugees, and has done more charity and committee work than this guy has ever heard of. If she's lazy, then he's a lump on a log. But she's a woman, and so of course her main job in this world is to present a figure that some men deem necessary to be sexually attractive. She could be working from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. every day, but if she's not out there losing weight, it doesn't count because being a woman should mean that her appearance is the only thing about her. Cavato plays the good guy, but let's face it, just by giving this jackass an opportunity to speak on TV, they're promoting the idea that a woman can be reduced to her dress size and written off completely if it's too big. If there's any doubt about that, Fox News did another segment bashing Dr. Benjamin for her weight on the O'Reilly Factor. They invited professional fat hater Mimi Roth on to bash Dr. Benjamin. Roth may not have a distinguished career or multiple degrees, but she is skinny, so she feels like she's morally superior.
Look, this was a real blunder on the part of the Obama administration. She clearly didn't meet the requisite of eating, you know, mindful eating and daily exercise. It should have precluded her from ever being, you know, in this really embarrassing situation.
Well, as I recall,
I like how she stuttered there. I think she was about to suggest that Dr. Benjamin shouldn't be allowed in public, but she caught herself and said that her presence in public was merely embarrassing. The only people here who should be embarrassed are the folks at Fox News for promoting the idea that someone's waistline, especially if someone is female, is the sum total of their character. I'll finish with Samita from Feministing's comments on the situation.
The last few weeks have shown us that when conservatives are up against a wall, they are very limited in their ability to come back with arguments. And so they focus on arguments that have to do with characteristics. And so when they can't disqualify somebody's credit, their merit, they make comments about them being fiery, as in the case of Judge Sotomayor. Or they say that they're fat, which is the latest hoo-ha over the appointee for Surgeon General, Regina Benjamin, who is, by any accounts, one of the most qualified people to be nominated for Surgeon General.
I'd like to welcome writer and journalist Lynn Harris to the program. Lynn is a writer for Salon, the author of Death by Chick Lit, and the founder of BreakupGirl.net. She's here today to talk about an article she wrote for RH Reality Check and Alternanet called When Partner Abuse Isn't a Bruise But a Pregnant Belly. Welcome to Reality Cast, Lynn.
Thank you.
I've done a little coverage about the issue of reproductive control on this podcast, but last time I did anything about it, there wasn't much known about it. But you found that a lot of anti-violence activists are reporting that this is a major problem.
Yeah, and they've actually known it for a while, anecdotally at least, and now more and more studies are showing that in many cases, teenage girls who are pregnant didn't plan to be, and by that, I don't mean that birth control failed, I mean that they tried to use birth control and their boyfriends in one way or another prevented them from doing that.
And do you mind explaining what are the various methods that the boyfriends tend to use are?
Well, some say some just are raped. Some just are forced to have sex before they can use any kind of birth control. You know, in many cases, as an aside, in many cases, women can't use the pill for their own personal medical reasons, for example. So, in some cases, they're forced to have sex. In some cases, their partners have either destroyed their birth control, hidden it, sabotaged it, or really, in a lot of cases, just said they're going to pull out, and they don't.
And the understanding is that most of the time they are trying to, if not like have a baby, at least get the girl pregnant or threaten her with it.
Yes. There, in some cases, I talked to some folks who work with youth in areas where gangs are prevalent, and in many cases, the guys are gang members who say things like, "You know, I'm not going to live that long, so I want to create some kind of legacy." You know, my response to that is, "You know, build a youth center." But there's also something poignant about that, of course. So they say, I want to perpetuate something in my life, and for many of them, experts say that for many of them, it's simply an issue of control.
And I got the impression from reading your article that this seems to be more of a situation with young people. Is that the impression you got when you were doing the research?
most of the studies that I read happen to be about young people. I think that may be in part because those are the populations that are being studied and that are easier to study. For example, those are the ones that, you know, are coming into, let's say, youth centers or involved in high school pregnancy programs. But I have heard anecdotally when I've mentioned this article to people that they've said, oh, I know someone that that happened to, and I'm and that's been when I'm speaking to people in their 20s and 30s and beyond. And I did one of the experts that I spoke with who has worked for many years with girls in abusive relationships confirms that, at least anecdotally, in her, you know, in her own experience, she has heard of it happening not only among among different age groups, but also, you know, it's not just gangs, among all classes and socioeconomic groups and different neighborhoods, different schools. It's really more of a individual psychology among, you know, between couples than anything, you know, caused uniquely by outside factors.
One thing I found also interesting about your article, and this is really kind of different from when I did interviews about this before. My impression in the past has been that this was kind of a small subsection of people in abusive relationships face this issue, or women in abusive relationships face this issue. But reading your article, it seemed like it was a lot more widespread. Can you talk some about how frequently abusers use pregnancy as a way to trap and control their victims?
Well, there was one small study. I mean, the going number for relationships that involve abuse, and I believe this number includes abuse by either, you know, in straight couples, by either the male or female partner, the going number is around around a third. You know, a third of all relationships are abusive in some way, about. Then you take, there was one study done, and again, it's a small study, but one study done in Boston among 61 girls in Boston who were racially and ethnically diverse. And among those 61, 53 of them were in abusive and sexually active relationships. So that's a lot, 53 out of 61. And, you know, it's hard to tease out. If you're in an abusive relationship, it's not like all of a sudden he's going to be nice when you have sex. Do you know what I mean? So it's not like you can really say, well, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of relationships. To be sure, there are plenty of relationships where, let's say, one member of the couple is emotionally abusive or physically abusive in a limited way. But to me, it just seems hard to draw a line between, a very clear line between, or to say that a relationship is physically abusive but not sexually abusive. Because, yeah, it's not like all of a sudden things are going to be great in bed when for the rest of the time they're not. And you could even have whether or not the abuse results in pregnancy or, to be sure, a sexually transmitted disease, coerced sex can also, or even just like gross sex, do you know what I mean? Can be part of unpleasant, undesired at a certain time. Sex can be part of the equation. But what a lot of the health people are saying is that, is the health experts are saying is that, look, this is also, never mind the fact that an abusive relationship is unhealthy as itself, you can also have the very clear and significant health repercussions, such as unintended pregnancy, such as STDs. And in fact, who study this stuff are saying that actually, you know, of course there are teenage girls who want to be pregnant, but they're also saying, let's assume, or let's at least ask the question, when a young woman comes in to a clinic, when a young woman comes into any sort of, you know, sort of youth advocacy health services program, when she comes in pregnant, when she comes in for repeat pregnancy tests, when she comes in for repeat STD testing, or as I said, if she comes in pregnant at all, let's at least ask the question, did you want to get pregnant? Was this part of the plan? Is there a reason you're coming in so often for STD testing? So that we can try to, so that the advocates and the health service providers can try to catch and address some of these situations.
So on top of using this kind of understanding to explain to health professionals ways they can screen for potential domestic violence, it seems to me that this would also could and should have an influence on how we teach condom use and condom negotiation.
Yeah, I mean, here we are saying abstinence, for never mind abstinence-only programs that, you know, can you imagine the girl sitting in a class saying, hearing, just don't have sex with a boyfriend who is forcing it on them. That's one thing. I mean, it's certainly not, you know, a virginity pledge is really not going to work in that situation. And yes, if you can know so much about condom negotiation and the medical properties of condoms, you can know only so much. And if you, no matter how armed you are with condom negotiation skills, you might have a partner who doesn't want to negotiate.
And do you think how do you feel that sex educators should address that question, knowing that you can say you should demand it, you should use it properly, but knowing that a lot of students in their class, that's just not an option for them?
Well, one thing, one of the, actually the researcher, the doctor who did the study I mentioned in Boston, Dr. Elizabeth Miller, one thing she says, and I know a lot of advocates agree with this, is that one of the solutions, or at least one of the approaches that needs to be changed, is separating out your sex ed class from your dating abuse awareness program, to the extent that schools have these at all, and in turn not separating those from your substance abuse awareness program. You know, she says, why should we have, you know, talk about drug abuse one week and sexual health another week and dating violence another week? They're all related. So to the degree that we can integrate those curriculums, then at least when you're talking about condoms, you can also talk about, you know, what do you do if, not just if the guy doesn't like condoms, but what do you do in a dating abuse situation? And it won't be off topic if all of these curriculums are integrated.
My guest today has been Lynn Harris. She's a journalist, a comic strip writer, a novelist, and an all-around awesome lady. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast and discussing this with us, Lynn.
My pleasure.
If you want to observe the surreal direction that wingnuttery has taken in American politics, you couldn't do any better than the short but storied national career of Sarah Palin. She just gave her final speech as governor, and it was heavy both on right-wing paranoia and incoherence. Watching the coverage of it was downright comical.
Andy, also, let's go to this. I'm going to read one. I was taking notes here, and she talked about the Second Amendment, and she said Second Amendment groups are going to be sending Hollywood starlets to take their guns away. We eat, therefore we hunt. That kind of reminded me of Drill Baby Drill, but Hollywood starlets taking the guns away.
Yes, and again, this is a big old applause line, not just in Alaska, where obviously lots of hunting up there, but in the Midwest, in the South, in the interior West, so many parts of this country that are hunters. Republicans have long used guns and the second protection of the Second Amendment as one of their main issues that they talk about in campaigns. There is nothing that you can say to conservatives other than the abortion issue that gets them more rallied than the idea of taking their guns away, the Second Amendment. So,
yes, you heard right. She accused Hollywood starlets of coming to take your guns, which tells you everything you need to know about how much wingnuttery is a result of bizarre psychosexual paranoia. Crowley was right to link the fear of your guns being taken from you to abortion for more than one reason. It's not just that both are applause lines. It's that both resonate with a crowd that is deeply concerned that lascivious women are plotting ways to symbolically castrate them by aborting pregnancies caused by strong American sperm or snatching your mighty phallic guns away. It's absolutely true that Sarah Palin is a master at stoking these fears and getting a lot of attention for it. But it's also obviously true that someone who buys into the weirdness like she does isn't suitable for making actual policy decisions. So now America's most baffling politician isn't a politician any longer. So what's going to happen to her? It was the question on the minds of the pundits.
Sure, she can make a lot of money, and that may have been part of why she's decided to chuck it in Alaska. But she could also be running for office. But it's a pretty uphill climb for her now. As I say, it was started to say that even people within the Republican Party, the numbers are rising of those who don't think that she understands complex issues. That's a problem. And there were a lot of people that said to her, you need to stay in office and you need to bone up on these issues.
To be frank, I don't think she has much of a future running for office. The nation is already remembering Barack Obama's election as something that happened strictly by the force of his charisma and intelligence, with a side of economic crisis. But let's not forget how quickly McCain's numbers started to slide downhill when the country started to realize that Palin might be quick with a nutty right-wing quip and good at winking, but she didn't really seem to understand the basic aspects of how government works. But I don't think she's going away. The hardcore base absolutely loves her. Where everyone else hears incoherent stabbing at right-wing talking points, the base hears someone who really gets them. Washington Journal took a call from one of the guns and sperm protection crowd.
Well, what's next for her? Well, I think she will run for president in 2012, your call screener asked me what I liked about her. I liked the fact that she is a Christian. I liked the fact that she is anti-abortion. I think that's why the Democrats are continuing to attack her, because they are the most afraid of anybody who has that kind of beliefs.
And that's what Rush Limbaugh has been saying as well.
Say that, and I agree. He agrees with me. I'll change that. He agrees with me.
There is clearly only one thing for Palin to do. In an atmosphere where most of the country thinks she's off, but the anti-choice crazies love her to death. Clearly, she's going to go into the activism and media realm. We've already heard Levi Johnston say that Palin was talking about how much money she should make with book deals if she resigned. And it's true. As any of us in the pro-choice world could tell you, we're facing down opposition that is willing to spend a lot of money to keep imaginary starlets from aborting your fetuses while running off with your guns. You don't have to be very smart or hardworking to be a major player in the world of anti-choice nuttery. You just have to be willing to be mean-spirited and thump the Bible with all your might. So that is the future I see for Sarah Palin. But I don't think she's going away. With that in mind, may I present William Shatner's reading of Palin's final speech as governor of Alaska.
Soaring through nature's finest snow. Denali, the great one, soaring under the midnight sun. And then the extremes in the wintertime. It's the frozen road that is competing with all of its ice-fogged, frigid beauty. The cold, though, doesn't it split the chichacos from the sourdoughs? And then in the summertime, such extremes. Summertime, about 150 degrees hotter than just some months ago, and then just some months from now.
And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. But we can't call it terrorism edition. Randall Terry of Operation Rescue went before the National Press Club and made obvious threats of violence that would happen if we get health care reform.
People simply refusing to pay their taxes and suffering the consequences for it. Number two, people not paying their taxes but filing in a less than honest and forthright way. Say, hey, I'm not required to incriminate myself. Number three, peaceful demonstrations and peaceful civil disobedience. Number four, random acts of violence against things, against facilities, things happening in the street, acts of vandalism. And then number five, God forbid, reprisals against the individuals who are deemed guilty by some person, perhaps on the fringe, individuals deemed guilty of pushing this tyranny.
Terry's excuse for threatening violence while claiming to oppose it is that there will be funding for abortion in the health care bill. As we've documented on this podcast, anti-choicers are just basically making that up. It's a cover story for a larger anti-healthcare agenda, and it's unsurprising to me that terrorism is being wielded as a threat to keep large numbers of Americans that the anti-choice movement deems unworthy from getting basic healthcare.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.